Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Yes, that's really Hail to the Chief, not the vice presidential theme we brought you last week.
I have become an artist.
The occasion is for George W. Bush, the artist, and his portrait of a daughter of Solon Springs.
And I'm truly honored that President Bush chose me.
Plus, when Matt Dressel was sending out copies of his screenplay and waiting nearly a decade for Hollywood to bite, he never dreamed he'd get a call telling him to go to a tropical island.
It was a surreal, unbelievable experience to be flown into the Cayman Islands.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Could it be romance?
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Yes, that's really Hail to the Chief, not the vice presidential theme we brought you last week.
I have become an artist.
The occasion is for George W. Bush, the artist, and his portrait of a daughter of Solon Springs.
And I'm truly honored that President Bush chose me.
Plus, when Matt Dressel was sending out copies of his screenplay and waiting nearly a decade for Hollywood to bite, he never dreamed he'd get a call telling him to go to a tropical island.
It was a surreal, unbelievable experience to be flown into the Cayman Islands.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So imagine you're an aspiring screenwriter from the Duluth Superior area, and you're dreaming of Hollywood. Actually, you're more than dreaming, and you even write a screenplay. You pitch it to more than 600 agents and film companies, and a few dozen actually get back to you, all of them rejecting it. Then one of those takes a second look, leading you to rewrite, and nothing. Years go by, fits and starts again. Then suddenly a financier appears, a cast, big names, and something about the Cayman Islands. But I'll let the star of this fairy tale tell it himself. Matt Dressel, welcome to Simply Superior.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I should say welcome back, because a year ago we had you on as the creator of Virtual Duluth, the online platform on Facebook for creative people to show their stuff through the COVID-19 pandemic. Can I say it has been quite a year since then?
It has. It's hard to believe it's been a year. I think that time has lost all meaning through COVID. And so, yeah, you could have told me any period of time was the last time we talked, and I would have believed you.
So tell us the story.
Well, basically, I mean, it starts off with writing a screenplay, and that was about 8 years ago. And then, there's any number of books, any number of classes, and people out there to tell you what to do once you've written your screenplay, how to get it out there. But there's really no one way to do it. You just kind of have to put your mind to it and think how you're gonna accomplish this. And so for me, it was sending out cold calling query letters to, production houses, managers, agents, whatever. And like you said, I sent out to about 600, but I did something a little special, because I've been pitching scripts.
Stop right there. Hold that thought.
Oh, yeah.
600. First of all, okay, we don't have Kinkles anymore. I guess you use the Office Depot, right? So that's like a day copies. Yeah.
It's all digital.
Okay.
It's very rare now that somebody requests a physical copy. So it's a lot of detective work, because if you don't have an agent, you don't have a manager, you have to find these companies. You get yourself a subscription to IMDb Pro, and it gives you their contact information. But still, it's a long process of tracking them down and figuring out exactly, who are the right producers to send it to, what companies have made things like this in the past. It's first a very focused search, but then as things become dire and nobody responds to you, it becomes a lot more broad, just like anybody, please read the script.
Right. The word's called desperate, isn't it?
So. Yes. Yes, exactly.
So yeah, go ahead. I interrupted you there, but I had to stop at that word because, it comes trippingly off the tongue, but it means a lot. Yeah. Right.
And it was a lot. That's kind of what you get used to when you're a screenwriter and you're out there pitching. But I, in the past, you know, I've just sent out what they call query letters, which is where you basically give your best pitch in about a page, and you put down what the script's about and why they should read it and all this stuff. And I was always bored to tears writing them. So I was like, I can't imagine anybody likes reading them. Yeah, exactly. So I happened to be, at the time, I was living in Southern California, and I was working at a movie trailer house. And I just got the idea, like, hey, why don't I use all of the, you know, facilities here and all the things I've learned about movie trailers and create this like really slick 45-second promo that gets across what the movie's about, but it's fun to watch. And it's not something that's like, that's laborious that they need to make their way through. And so that got me the hands down the most reads I've ever gotten. And it was only, you know, 50 or so that actually read the script, but, you know, by those numbers, that's actually not that bad. Like, a lot of screenwriters are lucky. All you need to do is talk to any struggling screenwriter out there. A lot of screenwriters are lucky to get like responses at all, let alone to have script reads. But, you know, that isn't to say they were all great. You know, I'm primarily a comedy writer, and it's a really tough genre to write in, because it's so incredibly subjective. And then people are always thinking about the international sales, and comedy does not travel well internationally.
Comedy doesn't travel well between Chicago and Duluth.
Exactly. Yeah.
Actually, it doesn't travel well between Duluth and Superior.
Yep. It's a hard sell. You know, it's not something that people normally want to touch. Mm-hmm. But I happened to find a production company that took a real interest in it. Leah Johnsums, she's the development executive that I've been working with for the last 8 years. And we, you know, together, she said, like, I see something really special in your script. The thing that she's told me from the beginning that always stuck with me was she said it was funny but forgettable. And that's always stuck with me. But she
that was actually funny, by the way.
Yeah. I've always had a difficult time. Like, I feel like I've never had much a hard time putting the funny into my screenplays, but it's finding the heart, finding the themes of your screenplay that, you know, that takes a lot to suss out when you're working with something. And so she came in and she was like, we need to, you know, your script is already funny. We need to find the heart. We need to find what it is about this that people will remember. What are the themes that people can connect to? And then it will be not only funny, but it will be memorable. So, right.
Well, there's an adage for public speakers and even those of us who do radio shows, which is people will not remember necessarily what you said, but they will remember how they felt.
Yes, that's a good saying.
We're speaking with Matt Dressel of Duluth. It was now Matt Dressel, writer and producer of the Cayman Islands-produced dark comedy Blue Iguana, but you had another name for it.
Yes, it was originally called Killing Daniel. The Blue Iguana shift came when we had to take the screenplay and basically change it from being set in the woods in northern Canada in a small cabin to a mansion on a private beach in the Cayman. So it was quite a transformation.
Oh, sure. Yeah, why not? Yeah, that sounds exactly the same. Yes. And I guess I jumped ahead by saying Cayman Islands, although I did introduce it earlier. So continue with the story. How did we get there?
Well,
You left us at Leah, and she was telling you that it was...
fun but forgettable, yes.
Yeah, funny but forgettable, yes.
Yeah, and over that 8 years, I felt like everybody that she knew read the script. I mean, it was sent to the president of the company, every intern there. I mean, it was we really worked on making that script tighter and funnier. And at one point there was even another director attached. These are just the ups and downs of film development. You know, we're following the attachments we get and the money we get at one point. There was funding from Northern Canada. I'm not sure if that's still attached strictly to the film, creative grants for that. I forget the exact names of them. I know some of them are still attached to the production.
Like, well, where's Northern Canada? Churchill, Manitoba? I mean,
we were going to be shooting in Sudbury. They're based out of Toronto, but we were going to be shooting in a small town in Sudbury when this was initially going to be a Canadian production.
Yeah. By the Canadian map, I just want to point out that is actually Southern Canada. But go ahead. Yes.
Well, that just goes to show how much I know about Canada.
It's north of, well, I'm not even sure it's north of here. But anyway, it's colder than here, if that's possible.
I think in my mind, I'm thinking it's north of me. It's north of us right here. So, so the money, we lost with COVID our funding, and it looked like it wasn't going to get made. And then this financier steps in, and he has this idea to essentially bring film infrastructure down to the Cayman Islands. And he tasked us with, he said, I love the script, and I think it can fit with the Cayman Islands if you're able to rewrite it. And, we were like, well, this movie's about a bunch of rich sociopaths. They most likely would own, it would make sense, it would track that they would own a lavish mansion in the Cayman Islands. So it was a tough rewrite in some respects, just because there were certain things that we realized really didn't work while we were doing the next pass.
Yeah, it seems to me even rich sociopaths wouldn't be hanging around Sudbury. But go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. So we had to change, a few things to get it going. But once we did, it was seriously like for the 8 years that I've spent waiting for something to happen, it really feels like everything happened within just a month. Like within a month, they were flying out crew and they were getting people ready, and they were it was everything. Everything was being done. We were attaching cast every other day, and next thing you know, we're all there. And it was a surreal, unbelievable experience to be flown into the Cayman Islands, just landing there, just because the entire island has been shut off. There's no tourism anymore. We were all brought in on special work visas. And so it was something else. But yeah, that crew, the crew that worked on my film is there for two other films at least. They're just jumping from one film to the next. My film wrapped and they had 5 days and they were already onto the next film.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking with Matt Dresso of Duluth. Who is now Matt Dresso, writer, producer, are you the Grand Poobah or is that the financier of the Cayman Islands-produced dark comedy Blue Iguana? Our program, I don't know if you've heard the last couple of weeks, but we've been looking at the Catalyst crew here, particularly their finances and their tax returns, because that's what we do.
Right.
So a big part of their pitch is for budding producers, TV producers, to have their wares nabbed by a Hollywood exec. And that hasn't happened in any large numbers. Again, maybe some contacts have been made, but nobody's gotten a big series out of it. If they have, we've asked, and we haven't received that information. You said earlier there is no magic bullet. It strikes me that the other person in town who got a major Hollywood deal is Chris Monroe for her Monkey with a Tool Belt series.
Oh, yeah.
It seems to me both of you got it based really on your talent. She already had a series of books, so it's not like she was unknown. Is that the formula, maybe talent?
I mean, I think it's just knowing. It's talent. It's hard work. It's knowing not, when to give up. I had, professional people that I considered mentors several years ago advising me to walk away from this project, just because on the face of it, it wasn't the most attractive thing. It's a long time waiting 8 years to get a film made, but I trusted in the people that I was working with. I think that goes a long way. You believe in what they've done in the past and you believe in what you're working on. I don't know enough about Catalyst to speak to whether or not they are the golden goose or anything like that. At the end of the day, it's really great to have festivals like this, because networking and creating connections with people is just tantamount to succeeding in this industry. You need to be able to talk with people. You need to be able to pitch your ideas. You need to be able to fail. You need to be able to succeed. I mean, all of this stuff. I attended the festival back when it was physical, and there is like a lot of camaraderie and there's a lot of great times. But yeah, I can't really speak to any of their other successes. I just always caution screenwriters in particular, just because I feel like we're particularly easy prey out there, especially when trying to get a film made. just to, you know, caution how much you're spending, how much you're putting of your own pocketbook to get made, because you can honestly, there's so many numbers of ways you can spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars trying to make it as a screenwriter. And usually
thousands
just,
and thousands.
Yeah. Thousands. I mean, yeah, thousands. Right, yeah. I'm being conservative. It's thousands. Right. And, I honestly believe at the end of the day, there is no secret ticket. It is just, it's hard work. And honestly, it's coupled with a little bit of luck, because who would have known that this whole Cayman Islands thing would have happened? I mean, that was just crazy out of the blue. But to get there, we needed a really tight script that we took 8 years working on to get made.
Well, you got it made, and you got it made with some pretty good names. Bob Saget, of course, needs no introduction. Who else do you have?
We have Joel David Moore, who's from the Avatar films. We have Jason Jones, who was from the original cast of The Daily Show. Marilyn Rice Cubb, who used to be on 24. And she's just one of those people where you just know her when you see her everywhere. And then we have Carly Chaikin, who was on the really popular Mr. Robot TV show. And Bob Saget, of course, who is America's dad, who was just, you know, I mean, everybody knows Bob. Bob was a huge cheerleader.
We all sent our videos to him at one point. Remember those
exactly,
videos?
Yeah. He's a huge cheerleader of the film. He really wanted to work to make his character even stronger. And he actually, you know, helped us workshop the script and make a few choices where it's like, yeah, he made his character have a much cleaner, nicer arc. And it really helps when the actors are like, are very much behind the script and want to make it the best it can be. And then the last attachment that came out of nowhere that we think we were all surprised about was, you know, Iggy Pop, who signed on at the last minute to play essentially what I don't know if I'd call it a cameo, because he's in a couple scenes, but I'd say it amounts to basically a kind of a longer cameo, where he plays the father of all of these horrible people. And he was just the nicest, just the sweetest person. And he knew his lines like left, right, and center. And just, he was an absolute delight to have on set. I think he re-energized the set when he came on, just because everybody was so happy to have him there. And we only had him for a couple days, but yeah, him showing up was definitely a highlight.
That's all you need, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Does he sing, or does he have any song he performs, or?
Nope. He's just showing off his comedic chops. And I think I've watched The Dailies. I was laughing. Like, I'm excited to see it cut in the movie. I think people are going to be really surprised by the performances from, you know, Iggy Pop, Bob Saget, all of it. Like, I think it's going to be a really, really tight film.
So tell us the plot as much as you want to tell us.
So the plot is about a family of wealthy sociopaths, with the exception of one, the brother Daniel is the nice one. And that's because he was sent away and kept from his family early on, so he didn't necessarily get their evil genes. And so the father dies, and he leaves a substantial amount of money to all of them. But the only way that they can claim their share of the inheritance is if they spend a weekend in their family house together. But instead of spending the weekend together, the siblings plot to kill their brother and just to absorb his share of the inheritance. Initially, actually, it was going to be a drama. It was kind of the same old thing of father dies, siblings come together. And it was something we'd seen, you know, a million times before. The siblings come together and they learn the error of their ways, and they see how they're similar and, you know, all this stuff. And then they come together in the end. And I was like, that's not entertaining. So I changed it to a dark comedy. And I was like, well, now I'm going to make them all kill each other. And
what power you have.
Yeah, it was a lot more entertaining to watch, you know, these sociopaths kind of go at each other. And it harkened back to the movies that I really like from the 80s and 90s. And it has like just a little bit of everything that I like, from, you know, dry, sarcastic humor to big, broad physical comedy, slapstick to it's a fun ride.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a little like Knives Out, no?
Yeah, that's kind of the, you know, when we were talking on set and doing our set interviews, people kept, you know, bringing up and saying it's kind of like a more R-rated Knives Out.
Oh, okay. All right. When Knives Out came out, it didn't make you go, oh, no.
Did it? No.
Okay. All right. When is it coming out?
That's up in the air just because of COVID. I think that they're, you know, everybody's kind of cautious about where movie theaters will even be in a few months. But I'm optimistic movie theaters will spring back very easily, but I'm not entirely sure. It could end up being a Netflix original film. It could end up being anywhere streaming online. Right now, I think they're just focused on getting the film cut, and then they'll worry about a distribution plan later.
It's maybe premature to ask, but what's next for Matt Dressel?
I think it's right now I'm just trying to figure out exactly what's next, because I know once the film comes out and
you
once,
won't remember you know, us anymore.
Yeah.
Robin who? Duluth? Where's that?
But I think right now I'm just kind of I feel like my head's still spinning. Like I feel like, oh my gosh, I was just in the Caymans a couple weeks ago. And I think I'm at this like at this rare crossroads right now where I'm trying to decide, you know, well, you know, I what is my next step? Like, do I want to work on more features? Do I want to keep working on a web series or any number of things? I think that once the film comes out, I think a lot of opportunities are going to pop up. And I think this is just kind of that in the calm of the storm where I'm just kind of figuring out, like, you know, what it is I want to be and what I want to do in my future. Just like everybody says, I mean, all it takes is just one thing to break through. It's a lifetime of no's, and all it takes is that one yes. And then when that one yes happened, it was like a month later and I'm in the Caymans.
Great. And again, we've been speaking with Matt Dressel of Duluth, who is the writer of the Cayman Islands produced dark comedy Blue Iguana. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Robin.
Coming up, a Solon Springs High grad gets a presidential portrait.
This question, ask one more. Could it be
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Last week, we brought you memories of the late Vice President Walter Mondale from people who knew him from his many visits to our region. This week, we bring you another former occupant of the executive branch, George W. Bush, and his connection to a longtime local resident who he sought out for a special honor. But it wasn't part of his official duties or writing his memoirs. Rather, it was in his capacity as George Bush, the artist. We'll introduce the subject of one of his recent paintings in a moment, but first, courtesy of the George W. Bush Center in Dallas, here's the story of how the former president evolved into his latest vocation, told in 2017 by Laura Bush and the president himself.
If someone had said when George and I married that he would become president, I might have said, well, maybe. He was interested in politics, and he was running for Congress in that early years of our marriage. But if someone had said, one day you'll be introducing George and talking about his paintings, I would have said, no way. George had never shown any interest in art. It all began with an iPad app called Pen Ultimate. George would sketch a little drawing on his iPad and email it to me or to the girls. In his early experiments with art, the ranch looked like this. And on a trip to Arizona, he sent his first self-portrait. Painting, even as a pastime, is serious business. It requires discipline, which makes it well-suited to George, or more to the point, George well-suited to it. George is disciplined and project-oriented, he gets his work done, and he brought that dedication to painting. Like any skill, painting takes practice, and George works a few hours every day in his studio. At the beginning, he was a pet portrait painter. He painted his parents' dogs, his sister's dogs, and his brother's dogs. And yes, they really do look like that. He painted our pets, who didn't mind posing and whose feedback consisted mostly of wagging tails or purring. But as much as George liked painting pets, He wanted to challenge himself. He began painting humans, even doing a few self-portraits. Every new painter, even a former president, finds himself asking the question, what or whom should I paint? And then there's this piece of advice given to many beginning artists. Paint what you know. As George began to think about possible subjects, he began to think about some of the people who he had found most fascinating. When he met with them, he didn't have a sketch pad in hand. He wasn't thinking about character studies or light or shadow. Yet in the hours and days that they'd spent together, he'd studied them all from a unique vantage point. Each of these men and women was someone he knew as a fellow leader. In painting the portraits of world leaders, George had both the perspective of an artist and the perspective of a president. After painting portraits of world leaders, George's instructor, Cedric Huckabee, suggested that George paint the faces of people that other people didn't know, the faces of the men and women who'd served our country. So George painted portraits of 98 wounded warriors. The portraits, along with the stories he wrote of the warriors, have been published in George's book, Portraits of Courage. I'm grateful that at last, George has a chance to develop his artistic eye. And I'm thankful for the nation that allowed us to serve it for 8 years. I'm happy to see my husband painting, and I'm pleased to introduce the artist himself, my husband, George Bush.
Good job. Good job, darling.
Thank you all. Thank you all. So, my life has changed dramatically in the post-presidency. One reason why is I'm no longer president. Second reason why is I'm a grandfather. Third reason why is because I have become an artist. I'm proof that old dogs can learn new tricks. I'm also proof that it's important to live life to the fullest. And even though part of you says you can't do something, it's important to try.
That was former President George W. Bush, preceded by Laura Bush, telling of his journey to his new career as an artist. One of his latest subjects is one of our own. Kimberly Mitchell was born in Vietnam and is very much a product of northwestern Wisconsin, specifically Solon Springs, where she was raised by a U.S. serviceman who adopted her from an orphanage in Da Nang, Vietnam. She went on to attend and graduate Solon Springs High School, and if you think you remember her working at the local Dairy Queen, you would be right. After high school, she entered the United States Naval Academy, going on to serve in the Navy for 17 years and becoming a lieutenant commander, and eventually working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington. She's now senior vice president for military, veteran, and government affairs at the National University in La Jolla, California, and going back to that commander title, she recently sat for a portrait by the former commander-in-chief, George W. Bush. Welcome to Simply Superior, Kimberly.
Thank you for inviting me, Robin.
So, Kim, President Bush has become quite known for his painting. How did he choose you?
That's a really good question, Robin, how President Bush chose me. I was actually part of the 2019 Stand to Veterans Leadership Program hosted by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. And it was during that time that I was notified that President Bush was very interested in my story and my background, where I was born, where I grew up, my service in the Navy, and that he would be interested in painting my portrait for the new project that he was doing, highlighting the achievements and contributions of America's immigrants in this book.
Mm-hmm. And he heard about your work at the Dairy Queen too, right?
Well, I'm not sure if President Bush heard about my work at the Dairy Queen. He has heard about my work though in the veteran space. He and his staff do a lot of programs supporting our service members, veterans, and their families. And so he and his staff and I have crossed paths as we work through a lot of the challenges that our folks face as they reintegrate back into civil society.
Mm-hmm. I promise not to bring up the Dairy Queen too many more times. So I know that you worked in two presidential administrations. Was one of them George W. Bush's, or
yes,
which ones were
yes,
those?
I actually was a White House military social aide for both President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama.
So was yours a face that he already knew, or...
Oh, yes. I worked over 200 events while he was president. So he definitely had seen my face. He didn't know back then my personal story and my background, but we definitely had crossed paths.
Right. And you, of course, didn't think of him as an artist at the time.
Well, no, because I don't believe he started painting until after he left office. And so...
We are speaking with Kimberly Mitchell, a subject of a painting by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. So what was the actual process like? How long did you sit for the painting, or was it also from photographs?
It was actually from photographs, Robin. As I was with the Stand Two Veterans Leadership Program, we had a module in Washington, D.C., and that's when they informed me. This was in September of 2019. They informed me that the president would be interested in painting my portrait. So the next day, his photographer, a gentleman named Grant Miller, pulled me aside and took a bunch of photos of me standing, sitting, kneeling, looking up, looking down, looking side to side, looking right at the camera. And so that the president would have a lot of different options to choose from, and he could choose which photograph that he would like to paint the portrait from.
Well, he's been doing this a while now, so I guess, you do that. I'm familiar with artists and people who do paint from photographs, but I hadn't thought of that, of having different angles like that to get different perspectives, because, you know, everybody is more than just their flat portrait. What was your reaction in the first place when you heard that he was interested in painting you?
I think my reaction was, he wants to do what? And me? Why me? Because, you know, Robin, I know you kind of briefly mentioned my background and my history. And yes, I was adopted from the orphanage in Da Nang. And I'm a naturalized citizen. I grew up in northern Wisconsin. But it wasn't until recently that I really... even consider myself an immigrant, you know, because first and foremost, I consider myself an American. That's the life that I've known. That's the life I grew up. And I'm deeply and truly honored that President Bush chose me to be one of the stories that he wanted to highlight in this book of immigrants that have succeeded here in America, that have stories that are just truly remarkable. And sometimes I feel like my story isn't, how does it compare with some of these stories that you read in the book that are just truly stories of courage and resilience and just determination. And I feel like I've been very blessed to be at the right place at the right time, and coupled with hard work to be able to get where I've gone. So I'm you know, like I said, the first time I was told, I looked at it, I said, what, me? Are you sure? So it is an honor for sure.
Right. And I think what you're saying is that, you know, the immigrant story, if you will, is not one story, right? It's extremely diverse.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we all have stories. As everyone says, we all have a story, right? But the stories of immigrants and folks coming to America in search of a better life, in search for a way to be successful and to give back to their communities and to be able to work hard and provide for their families. I mean, that's, and to become an American, right? To be, as I was watching some interviews, I think President Bush really put it eloquently when he said that, you know, when you come to America from another country and you raise your right hand and you take that oath, you are an American. for me, I have an immense sense of pride to be an American right now because of just this honor.
Mm-hmm. When you took that oath, though, you weren't that old.
No, I mean, I left Vietnam when I was 10 months old. I was a naturalized citizen when I was 5 years old. So I have a newspaper clipping from the front page of the newspaper from at Portales, New Mexico, I guess it's where it was. It was 10 immigrants becoming naturalized Americans, and I was one of them. I was the youngest one, and of course, the photographer at the time somehow zeroed in on me to be a picture on the front page of the paper.
So you've attracted photographers and artists all your life, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't know if I want to say that, but somehow I did attract attention, and that was the first time I was ever on the front page of a paper.
All right, great. We're speaking with Kimberly Mitchell, a graduate of Solon Springs High School and also the U.S. Naval Academy, and a veteran of 17 years in the Navy and then working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and in the White House. She is the subject of a portrait by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. So the final portrait, when you saw it, what was your reaction?
I actually saw it a couple weekends ago when I traveled to Dallas to go view the portrait. And I deliberately didn't look at the book that had been sent to me because I wanted the first time in seeing the portrait to be the actual portrait. And I was slightly emotional because I could tell it was me. And you know, I looked at it and I was like, wow, I've never had someone paint a portrait of me before. So I'm looking at it and I just had this immense sense of pride to be an American as I'm looking at this portrait amidst all these other portraits of Americans. Yeah, when President Bush asked me what I thought of it, I said it's very well done. So,
well, not every artist gets that from their subjects, believe me. There's a long history to that. And you mentioned, you know, you were among portraits of other Americans, but he's painted people from all over the world. He started by doing some world leaders. Not all of them would necessarily be as fond of the work as you were. Not saying anything about the president. I'm saying that's what happens with art, right? You know, the artist portrays you in the way the artist portrays you.
Right.
But you don't have to be the critic, yes.
I love the portrait. And I think it's a very unique perspective because I'm not looking directly. I'm kind of looking off to the side, so I love the aspect that he chose.
Mm-hmm.
I think the title of his book, Out of Many One, right? That and we see that model all the time, E Pluribus Unum. I think it's a perfect title for his book because I think it just shows the diverse perspective that really makes up America.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you to get political or anything like that, but, you know, the last 4 years, we haven't had quite the same message from the White House about immigration, or immigrants in particular. So I'll put you this much on the spot anyway to say, does this help maybe normalize the thinking? I mean, the very title that you just said, that immigrants are part of all of us.
Absolutely. I hope and pray that this does create conversation and create some understanding that we are a nation of immigrants. And so, you know, I have always said in many of my speeches across the country is that we are stronger together when we have common goals and common dreams.
Who else is in the book?
Well, there's actually quite a few folks. I know Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is in the book. Henry Kissinger is in the book. Madeleine Albright is in the book, as well as many others. Folks that I think I saw an interview with President Bush where he kind of chose famous and not famous people, is what he said. So There's a lady, and if you get the book, her name is Jean Celestine, and her story is just absolutely amazing. It actually brought me to tears when I read her story in the book. So
actually, I just looked it up online, and I'm reading here Jean Celestine Lakin saw her entire family slaughtered in front of her at just 9 years old during the Rwandan genocide, and now shares her remarkable story of survival and forgiveness. On a much lighter note, with Arnold Schwarzenegger included, it looks like the president was concentrating at least in part on Northwest Wisconsin and the University of Wisconsin-Superior, with Arnold being a graduate.
Yes, he was at University of Wisconsin-Superior. Some of my friends remember him. And I did attend University of Wisconsin-Superior for 1 year while I was at home. After my father had been struck by lightning and killed on our farm in 1991, I did return home from the Naval Academy for a year to help out my family and the farm. And so while I was there, I did take classes for the year at UWS and then went back to the Naval Academy the next year. So.
Mm-hmm. And family is still here?
No. I have some aunts and uncles and cousins down in southern Wisconsin. That's about it.
In fact, did I say I was not going to mention the Dairy Queen again or that much? I'm sure you can stop by there and get a blizzard or whatever you want. We've been speaking with Kimberly Mitchell. She's a graduate of Solon Springs High School and a U.S. Naval Academy and had a 17-year career in the Navy, and the subject of a portrait by former President George W. Bush in his Portraits of Immigrants series. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Robin. It's a pleasure being on the show with you today.
Coming up, the regional news and review after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Brooks, PolyMet continues to be in the news. I don't think they've ever left being in the news, but there's new developments going on.
Yes, the decades-long proposal to open Minnesota's first copper-nickel mine hit a snag this week after the state Supreme Court overturned PolyMet's permit to mine. So state regulators will have to take this up again for further review, which environmental groups claim victory on the decision, saying that they need a contested case hearing on this, especially on the mine's tailings dam. The state Supreme Court said, the DNR erred by issuing the permit without an appropriate fixed term, which is to say the state regulator should have set a date by which the mine and wastewater would be cleaned up and returned to nature. So we haven't started mining yet. We're already looking at the end of the mine, which needs to be part of that process. There's another proposed mine in northern Minnesota, Twin Metals. Just so folks know, these are two separate projects. The PolyMet mine is the one proposed in the St. Louis River Lake Superior watershed, Twin Metals in the Boundary Waters watershed.
All right. Well, what if we don't want to go up north and instead we just want to get away from here? What are our options these days?
There are some more options coming, not till this winter, but more options coming to fly directly out of Duluth International Airport and down to the Southwest or to Florida. So Sun Country Airlines this week, the Twin Cities-based budget airline, said it would start seasonal nonstop flights from Duluth to Phoenix and to Fort Myers, Florida. Those flights would run twice weekly. They start at about $79 per person one way, which sounds pretty good, honestly, looking at it myself. And it's part of a major expansion for the airline, which added another 16 routes, including some in Rochester and Green Bay.
All right. And if you don't want to get away, but you want a drink or a whole bunch of drinks and you want a whole jug to put them in, how's that going?
Well, in Minnesota, we've got some tricky brewery laws that have left a handful of breweries unable to sell growlers of their product on premise. Castle Danger Brewery in Two Harbors he's one of those, in a bill that would fix this so-called growler cap, which is to say it would allow larger breweries to sell growlers, failed to gain significant traction in the closing weeks of Minnesota's legislative session. It sounds like it's just not going to happen this year. So breweries that produce more than 20,000 barrels of beer a year will probably remain prohibited from selling growlers on premise. That includes Castle Danger, but also Surly, Fulton, and a few others that are well known around the state.
All right. Well, Danny, on the Wisconsin side and back to heavy industry, what's the latest on the Husky plant?
Yeah, so, you know, 3 years ago, the explosion rocked the refinery here in Superior, injuring 3 dozen people and causing a temporary evacuation of the city. And now we still don't have a final report from the U.S. Chemical Safety Board into the blast. Although preliminary findings have been released, the board hasn't issued its final report, and that's because they are seeing a shortage of investigators and unfilled board positions that are contributing to a backlog. And so, you know, Husky right now is in the middle of a $750 million rebuild, and it's basically, Superior's Mayor Jim Payne said that the best opportunity for any safety improvements is during the reconstruction or redesign of that refinery. And if this report comes out with any new recommendations about a change in their operations, then it's going to be much harder to do that once the refinery is rebuilt. But, you know, Husky, which was recently bought by Cenovus Energy, you know, they're saying that they're committed to safety when the refinery restarts operations in 2023, but it's concerning to some residents who live near the refinery, although supporters of the project have highlighted, you know, this brings 200 or roughly 200 permanent jobs to the region and millions in revenues via payroll and taxes. And so, people are really kind of concerned over the lack of this final report and what that might mean for the community.
Right. I know this may not be a direct comparison of competitors or not, but with Husky sort of on hold there, Enbridge might have a leg up or not?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, Robin, because with the Line 5 reroute project in northern Wisconsin, there's quite a bit of opposition to that. Again, you know, Enbridge is looking to reroute a roughly 40-mile stretch of its Line 5 oil pipeline in Ashland and Iron counties, and that all came about after the Bad River Tribe filed a lawsuit against the company seeking to shut down and remove the line from their tribal lands. And so during spring hearings that are held each year by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, they asked voters, you know, whether they would support this organization if they opposed that project. And around half of voters who weighed in said that they do oppose construction of this Line 5 reroute. It was kind of close. You know, there was a lot of people who decided not to weigh in. Around 34.5% said they wouldn't oppose the project. 16.5% had no opinion. So it's something that's generating a lot of debate. And right now, they're still going through the permitting process with the DNR here in Wisconsin. They haven't released the draft environmental impact statement yet on that work. And you know, Enbridge is coming under more scrutiny right now in Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin as the Biden administration has taken over, and they're being pushed by pipeline opponents to shut down these projects, just like with the Keystone XL pipeline. So we'll see what happens related to these projects as they move forward.
Right. And as you point out, it affects several different states. On the Minnesota and Wisconsin border, health officials are expressing concerns about COVID-19 protocols.
Yeah. 21 local and tribal health departments this week signed on to a letter urging people to continue being vigilant and wearing masks and social distancing because they're concerned of the rising caseload in nearby Minnesota. And so a lot of these counties that signed on, including Douglas County and Burnett County and St. Croix County, they're all border counties with Minnesota. And officials are just concerned that they might see the COVID-19 variants spread throughout the community. And the more that the disease spreads, the more it could potentially mutate and the more it could be harmful to others. And so They're urging people to get vaccinated. Kathy Ronke said, you know, less than half of Douglas County, where she's the health officer, less than half of county residents have been vaccinated so far, and about a third of residents have been fully vaccinated. So she's really trying to urge people that, you know, maybe if you think that this virus isn't something that harms you, think about other people and how it could circulate in the community and potentially cause more harm. And so they're just really pushing that people need to keep up their guard. You know, even though we've got the vaccine out there, you still need to be wearing masks until the CDC eases those guidelines, which we saw earlier this week. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention eased up on guidelines for masking for people who are vaccinated. So things are getting better, but they're just saying continue to be vigilant.
All right. Well, team, I have one for you. Along with our features this week, I'm Matt Dresso and Kimberly Mitchell. Here's yet another local boy makes good story, can we call it? Thomas Nyes of Duluth and Duluth East High School class of 1979 is said to be President Biden's likely choice as the next ambassador to Israel. He spent years in banking, and he was a deputy secretary of state under Hillary Clinton in the Obama administration. But here's yet another local connection. Dan Shapiro was ambassador to Israel during that same period, and he happens to be, wait for this, guys, married to Julie Fisher, also of Duluth.
Ah.
Yeah, with her parents' longtime congregants at Duluth Temple Israel. So, again, local people making good all over the world here.
Very cool.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. Next week, play ball. The Northwoods League is starting up, and we'll bring you a special of the minor league teams, including our own Duluth Huskies. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with, in honor of the cameo co-star of Matt Dressel's Blue Iguana, Iggy Pop with Lust for Life. Stay safe, everyone.